It's a Thursday edition of Locked On Heat. On today's show, we're going to talk about what Josh Richardson says he's going to work on this offseason and how his role may change next season.
Then we'll go back in Heat history for Throwback Thursday, review what's been happening in the NBA playoffs as well. Thank you so much for listening and for subscribing. Now let's get to the show.
You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, let's do this. Welcome to Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. My name is Wes Goldberg. I'm a credentialed writer covering the NBA for the Step Back, and I write for the Miami Heat's Tip-Off magazine. You can find me on Twitter at WC Goldberg.
I'm David Ramil, a credentialed NBA writer who's covered the Heat for SB Nation and allyoucanheat.com. I cover the league at large for Fanside, and you can follow me and my writing on Twitter at DRamil13.
On today's show, we'll take a look at some games that took place on this day in Heat history. And then we're going to go over some of the current playoff action. But let's start with what Josh Richardson had to say during his exit interview about how he thinks he can get better.
That I'm capable of, you know, being a great player in this league. You know, I think I show flashes, and I think I just have to do it consistently. Ball handling is one of them. I want to be able to have the ball on a string next year so I can play like in ISO situations more.
David, he mentions being able to contribute in isolation situations. Do you agree that that's the next step for him?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we saw too often that Josh Richardson deferred a little bit on offense, wasn't able to necessarily create the kind of shot that we would hope for, milked the clock a little bit too long on occasion. So we need him to be a little bit more dynamic with the ball and kind of rather than just make that quick dribble drive and then pull up for a 19-footer or something like that. The mid-range game, obviously not as efficient as it was once previously believed to be, and so we're trying to shy away from that. Unfortunately, Josh's game is a little bit too much of a throwback in that sense, but hopefully he can make that adjustment over the offseason.
Yeah, you know, Miami's offense this year wasn't really asking it about any of the players to really contribute in isolation situations, but we saw that in the playoffs. They could have used somebody like that, and we've spoken in the past about having somebody like a Dion Waiters who may have been able to contribute in that kind of way, but Miami finished near the bottom of the league in isolation points, total isolation points scored throughout the season. Actually, there was only two teams that scored fewer isolation points, and that was the Spurs and the 76ers. Mm. And both the Spurs and Sixers are in the playoffs, right? So it's not like you need to score isolation points in like bunches in order to be a really elite team. But then you go to the top, right? And Houston and Cleveland are the top two teams in isolation points per game.
Well, I mean, there's reasons for that, though, right? I mean, like, think about Miami's offense in comparison to San Antonio and Philadelphia. Those two teams swing the ball, looking for the right shot. It's not necessarily about a last second heave as the shot clock is ready to expire, which is how often it looks like with Miami. It's that they get it stuck in a situation where they can't create because there's not a dynamic offensive player on the roster, you know, with the exception of maybe, again, like you said, Dion Waiters. And that's unfortunate because then you wind up having to put the ball up. Yeah, then you pass a lot. It's not like it's Oklahoma City where it's just relying on one ball handler. But at the same time, there's a lot of passing going on, but it's often at the last second and then hoping for a shot to fall.
And you look at teams like San Antonio and Philadelphia, at the end of a shot clock, if drive, kick, swing doesn't work, the Spurs could just throw it into LaMarcus Aldridge.
Right.
And the Sixers can just rely on either Joel Embiid, they could do the same thing, or even Ben Simmons, who can get to the rim much easier than anybody on Miami can. Both the Spurs and the Sixers, despite finishing with fewer total isolation points this season, have a higher points per possession.
Yeah.
Per isolation possession,
that
speaks to just having that they have an option. Miami doesn't even have an option. You know, Hassan Whiteside.
Nope.
They kind of tried to make him the option at the start of the season.
Did not work.
Didn't necessarily work out. So if Josh Richardson can be that guy for Miami, that would be huge. Now again, I don't see the Heat getting up there with Cleveland and Houston and OKC as far as playing an ISO heavy offense. That's just not the way Spoelstra likes to play, and that's fine. These stats show you can win either way, but having somebody to basically bail out the team in the last few seconds of the shot clock would be huge. And if that could be Josh Richardson, he would be so valuable as just being the young player that he is, being able to contribute defensively the way he does. If he can also add that kind of isolation game to his offensive game, his ceiling would just increase exponentially. I mean, he would just be – he would go from arguably the most valuable player on the team to easily the most valuable player on the team.
Now, let's look at what it would actually take for him to be more valuable in ISO situations. I mean, I think you could probably point out to at least one thing where he'd probably have to put on enough weight where he could handle the wear and tear of constantly driving to the rim. And drawing contact, something that I've harped on about all season. He just doesn't get to the free throw line a lot. When you look at players like LeBron James or James Harden, you know, two of the top isolation players in the game, they get to the free throw line a lot. That's a big part of the game. And you know, Josh just doesn't have that in him. So I think that's one thing. He does have a nice array of moves, right? He's got a good offensive repertoire. He's got that scoop shot, obviously. He's got a good turnaround. I think he can create offense for himself in the post pretty easily. I mean, he can back down a defender if he has to. And again, he does have a nice jump shot. I just don't think he goes to it often enough. And then that might be the third part then, right? Yeah, I need to be a little bit more aggressive and say, you know what, clear out. I'm going to take this. I can't be stopped. And I just think that that's a problem with that, with him, that he just doesn't feel that level of confidence right now.
Yeah, you mentioned the scoop shot. That's like his only move when he's driving towards the rim, right? And that's not – that's one that's that move is designed to avoid contact and to get a shot off, which is valuable in certain situations. But he needs another move. He mentioned, you know, having the ball on a string, you know, in that soundbite that we played. And I think that would be a huge part of it. Just, you know, he's never going to be Kyrie Irving, right? But if you can, you know, add some dribble moves, increase, increase the sliders on your handle, so to speak, so that you can just create a little bit more space when you've got the ball in your hand. Yeah, he's got a nice turnaround jumper, but that doesn't involve ball handling. He's among Miami's best mid-range shooters, and I think it was him and Dragic that were Miami's best mid-range shooters before the addition of Dwayne Wade, and so he's got that. But if he can just sort of, you know, just not, you know, Deion Waiters, we saw him. He's kind of more of a physical presence, but he does have an underrated handle, I think, and he's able to get to his spots a little bit easier. I think Richardson, that's what he needs to do. He just needs to increase his handle, improve that so that he could just find his spots and get to his spots, just sort of, you know, under his own control and just being able to get the shots that he wants off. And a lot of that is just having better handles. And you mentioned also getting bigger. I think that would be another big thing for him. So that you're right. So he can finish through contact and do things like that.
Yeah, I think that would be great. And then, you know, one of the things that we talked about as far as like the next step for Richardson and on a macro level, something that we've talked about before is that maybe this is a good opportunity for him to kind of work outside of the Heat dynamic and maybe make contact with guys like Irving and maybe Dwayne Wade or others, you know, somebody around the league who might have a better handle that he can kind of work on, go through those same drills so that he can expand his game and kind of make more of a presence, because I think he just doesn't really have one league-wide. He's not the kind of guy that, you know, as we talked about, especially in context of free agency, nobody's coming to Miami to play with Josh Richardson. As good as he is and as high as the ceiling might be, I just don't think he has those kind of connections league-wide, and I think he needs to kind of expand that a little bit.
Maybe he can spend the summer with Dwayne Wade. I mean, that wasn't an option the last couple summers,
right? That's
a good point. So maybe he just spends the summer with D-Wade in South Beach, and Wade can teach him a few things. I mean, he's already kind of resembling Wade defensively with all the blocks that he's getting.
What's the name of the trainer in Miami that worked with Victor Oladipo?
David Alexander. Yes. He's also Wade's trainer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Good point.
You're reading my mind right now, because I think Richardson should go there.
Yeah, I mean,
go to DBC Fitness in South Beach and just be the next Oladipo. Be the next, you know, take that leap.
That's a good point.
You know, it's not as easy, but
but to strengthen his core and, you know, with Oladipo, as you wrote so wonderfully, I mean, just changing his hips and kind of strengthening so he has more explosiveness. I mean, that's what you're kind of looking for out of Richardson. So it would be a good first step. Another guy is Drew Hanlon, who I got a chance to talk to. He works for Kelly Oubre Jr. I mean, he's got guys like Embiid, Jason Tatum, Bradley Beal in his repertoire. So, I mean, obviously they've a pretty extensive clientele list. Either one of those guys. There's a number of these guys now that specialize in getting players and helping them reach the next step in their development. You know, something I don't think teams can do. Like, they can't focus on any one player because you've got 15 on your roster. It's a little different.
And Richardson, he's been young and he's been spending his summers kind of like, it's been the Rook 1, Rook 2 summers. Sure. He spends a lot of time with Winslow, with Tyler Johnson, with James Johnson. Right. But that's not – you're right. I think with Richardson sort of showing the flashes that he's talked about, maybe it's time to just get a little bit more – not saying he wasn't serious, but to just to take that – to turn the page and take that next step and into just – you know, being a fanatic about, you know, his body and right. and his development of skills and things like that. It might be time for him to do that, especially because he's an older player for how long he's been in the league, and he's really entering his prime right now. Now's the time to capitalize. And Richardson's future is promising, but we're going to go back in our next segment and look at what a few things that happened today in Heat history after this quick break. The playoffs are here, and just like the Miami Heat, it's time to step up your game. If you run a company and you're unhappy with the results from traditional advertising online or in print, make a big-time adjustment by advertising with us here on Locked On Heat. We've already got national brands advertising on the show, but it's also a great opportunity for South Florida businesses to connect with local Heat fans. You've heard about the studies already, how podcast listeners are 65% more likely to engage with advertisers, and how the number of people listening to podcasts continue to grow every year, heck, every month. Be ahead of the curve and start advertising on a podcast with us here at Locked On Heat. You have nothing to lose by reaching out, and our rates are reasonable, and they're based on the number of listens, so it's an efficient use of your time and your money. For more information on next steps, email us at lockedonheat@gmail.com. That's lockedonheat@gmail.com, and we could be talking about your company right here on the show. Back with Locked On Heat, we're debuting a new segment. And it's called Throwback Thursday, where we go back and relive some moments that happened on this day in Heat history. So, David, I dug up some games that happened on May 3rd over the years. I'm just gonna go through them, and I want you to tell me which one jumps out at you when I'm done, and which one of these that you want to talk about. Are you ready? Are you ready to just go back into the? All right, so we're going into the time machine here. Let's start in 2011. The first playoff season, the first season of the Big Three, their first playoff experience together. Miami beats Boston 102-91. The Heat come out fired up, looking to take a 2-0 lead in the first playoff series between the Big Three Heat and those sort of Big Three Celtics with Garnett, Pierce, and Ray Allen. The Heat took over in the fourth quarter as LeBron finished with 35 points. D. Wade had 28. David, the Heat started Mike Bibby and Zydrunas Ilgauskas in that game. Is that a throwback or what?
That's absolutely a throwback. I looked at Big Z's impressive two-point outing there, and I remember why we didn't have much of a center during those first two seasons in the Big Three era.
Let's go to 2016. We're jumping all over the place. Miami beats the Toronto Raptors 102-96. Now, I think a lot of listeners will remember this one the most, just because it was the most recent that we're going to go through here. The Heat's backcourt of Goran Dragic and D. Wade outscored the Raptors' backcourt of Kyle Lowry and DeMar DeRozan 50-29. As the Heat won the first game in their second-round series. That ended up going seven games, but we remember what happened. The Heat eventually lost that series after an untimely injury to Hassan Whiteside, who in that game one was bested by Jonas Valanciunas. Valanciunas had 24 points and 14 rebounds compared to Whiteside's 9 points and 17 rebounds. That was the first time that we saw Dragic and Wade together. That was the season that the Heat brought Dragic in, and then it didn't necessarily work out after that, and then they had a reunion of sorts this season.
I think this actually was
It was the second season that they brought Dragic in.
They brought him in 2015, yep. Midway through that season. Again, without Chris Bosh in this one. The matchup that stands up again, and I'm glad you pointed it out, is that Valanciunas Whiteside one, because I was convinced going into the series, I remember even writing about it, that I thought Whiteside had a clear advantage, and I had never seen anybody shrink from the moment as much as Whiteside did. So,
well, until Whiteside this playoffs,
oh,
right?
Well, yeah, but that's just kind of adding until that's the cherry on top. He built that Sunday in 2016. You know, he's just been adding all sorts of shitty sprinkles to it since then.
Shitty sprinkles. Then let's go to 2012. This is a good one, David. Miami beats the Knicks 87-70, 17-point win. This was the last time the Knicks made the playoffs. It was that one good Carmelo Anthony season, remember, with the Knicks? That was the one time that they made the postseason. They still weren't good enough for the Big Three Heat, who on this day took a 3-0 lead in the series thanks to 32 points from LeBron and 19 points from Mario Chalmers, who made 5 of his 8 three-pointers in the game. Melo, he had 22 points, but on 23 shots.
No, really? Carmelo inefficiently? Like, I mean, I know a lot of people, this is the kind of box score you have to point out when people are talking about acquiring Carmelo Anthony. I know a lot of the talk and the context is about getting Anthony because eventually his contract comes off the book and the books, and if you can move either Tyler Johnson or Hassan Whiteside, it makes sense for the financial freedom that that provides. But I don't know that I could watch 75 games of Carmelo putting up 30 shots a game and hitting like a third of
them. I know.
Like,
I know.
That's just painful.
I tweeted that after. I was like, look, logically, if the Heat are trying to rebuild, it makes all the sense in the world. And I have on this show, we have debated this. I think I am more willing than you to sit through a lousy Heat season for the sake of quote unquote tanking or just getting a draft pick or just creating enough cap space to make a run.
You say that.
I can't, but I draw the line at Carmelo Anthony.
Okay. But you also remember how hard it was to record a daily podcast when we were 11-30 during that.
But we didn't
want to
be 11-30. We didn't have a draft pick. Like, that was the thing.
Oh, yeah. But we were still talking about it. We were taking every mailbag question was, so can we trade Goran Dragic since we're already, you know, terrible anyway?
I understand what you're saying, and I hear what you're saying. We don't need to open up Pandora's box again. But if the design was to tank, like if the Heat just came out, okay, let's just trade everybody and tank, I would have been a lot happier. We could have just talked about the draft for an entire year. I would have been happy with that. All right, let's move on.
One more thing about this game, though. Sorry, one more thing. Isn't this the game where Chris Bosh was there for the birth of his child and then had to fly back to New York to be part of this game?
Was that this one?
I think it was against New York. I know that. I remember him talking about being stuck in traffic in New York and having to fly back there. So, I mean,
Bosh had 9 points on 5 shots, 10 rebounds. Oh, yeah, he had a great plus minus. This is one of those Bosh games where he just didn't score but like did everything.
Right.
So, all right. Well, maybe it was. All right. Now let's go all the way back to 1994, David. Miami beating the Atlanta Hawks 90-86. This game's the box score on Basketball Reference is great because it's got both throwback logos on it. Really just takes you back.
Yes.
Ronnie Cicely had 20 rebounds and 12 points. Steve Smith scored 25. A guy by the name of Bimbo Coles added 14 points off the bench. Miami takes a 2-1 lead in the first round series, but they ended up dropping the next two and were eliminated. For the Hawks, a man by the name of Craig Elo, who I don't remember, but according to Basketball Reference, has the nickname.
You do know Craig Elo. You do know Craig Elo. He's the guy who's falling down on the court in Cleveland when Michael Jordan hits that shot.
Oh, that's right. I knew I recognized the name. But you know what I didn't recognize? That he had the nickname Eggs, according to Basketball Reference. Does anybody know that?
No, I don't think that's real. I honestly don't think that's something real.
All right. He also had Mr. Everything.
Basketball Reference has these nicknames that, I don't know, maybe they were referred to once at some point. They're like, yes, clearly, that's his nickname, Eggs.
The reason I pointed out Craig Elo is he scored a 20 points off the bench for the Hawks, which I just thought was interesting. Yeah, he was the guy that was falling down. And I just needed, like, I looked him up and I was like, Eggs, we got to talk about Eggs.
Craig Elo was a pretty stereotypical player for the 70s and 80s. And I'm sorry, 80s and 90s. I don't think he played in the 70s. No. He might have. You know, he was just one of those guys. You know, it's funny. I was reading a book about the Cleveland Cavaliers like in the early 80s called 48 Minutes. And it talks a lot about Elo. He was kind of like a scrub player, kind of toiling about and not really. I think he was in the CBA. And then he gets the call up to join the Cavaliers. And anyway, this was the start of that career for him, was that, you know, he was just a dead-eye shooter, not particularly good, hustled a lot, you know, a guy that you would probably label gritty in today's NBA, but that's just code for him being kind of unathletic and white, and that's just the reality. Bimbo Coles, hell of a point guard, let me tell you.
If you could go back and attend one of these games, which one of them would it be?
Wow, that is a good one. To be honest with you, I'd probably go for the Miami-Boston one just because the vitriol was so rich and being able to knock off the Celtics just felt like such a reward for this Big Three team. Obviously, ended pretty badly in the finals against the Dallas Mavericks, but this run just showed what they were capable of, and being able to knock Boston off the perch just felt so good. So I'd have to go with the Celtics game. How about you?
I would do the same thing. That was the game where LeBron, there was a steal. LeBron gets the ball in transition, and Rondo tries to draw the charge at the free throw line, and LeBron just spins like spins through him, not around him, not just like spins through him, and Rondo falls over flopping trying to draw the charge, and the refs ignore him, and LeBron just dunks it, and I just I would have chosen that game for that moment, just to just lose my mind when LeBron dunked it after spinning through Rajon Rondo. That would have been great.
That one, and of course the game a couple years later where he murdered Jason Terry on national television.
Yeah. If I could, like, that didn't happen on May 3rd, but if it did, that would have been the one. That would have been the one. All right, that's enough of old playoff games. Let's look at what's been going on in the second round of these playoff games so far. We'll do that when we come back after this break. Before we move on with the show, we want to take a quick break and tell you about our Patreon page. You can find it by going to patreon.com/lockedonheat. And we are humbly asking for people to commit to a monthly pledge to help us continue to improve the quality of the show. Thanks to you who have already supported the podcast, we have quickly reached our initial funding goal that allowed us to purchase software that improved the quality of the podcast. But we aren't just stopping there. We've added a new tier of supporters. For $5 a month, you'll get access to a bunch of goodies, including salary cap and depth chart projections, free agency player rankings by position, a running list of our favorite trade ideas, and whatever else we can think of. Just go to patreon.com/lockedonheat to get started. Again, that's patreon.com/lockedonheat. That's patreon.com/lockedonheat. Back with Locked On Heat. A lot of interesting playoff action going on right now. Already the Jazz beat the Rockets, so that series is tied 1-1. Cleveland stole a game in Toronto, and Boston has a 1-0 lead over the Sixers in their second round series. But let's start, David, with that Jazz game from last night. You and I were texting a bit this morning. You mentioned how even with Utah's quote-unquote like starless roster, they have managed to compete in the West. Do you see a I think you do. What is the difference that you see between the Heat and this Jazz team that have been compared quite a bit?
Well, I mean, you could make a case, I guess, that Donovan Mitchell has been the team's biggest star, but even in their victory against Houston, he had a pretty bad shooting night.
Yeah.
I think it was just getting contributions from guys that you don't normally expect it, and that's just kind of how Miami's built as well, right? I mean, you get a Kelly Olynyk game, or you get a Justice Winslow game, et cetera. Last night, it was Joe Ingles, who has been phenomenal, and Jay Crowder. So I think, you kind of built similarly to Miami, but I think ultimately the difference really is Utah plays defense a whole hell of a lot better than Miami does. As much as Miami might pride themselves defensively, I think the presence of Rudy Gobert and the active on-ball defense from the perimeter players on Utah's roster kind of makes them stand out above what Miami's able to do. And you know, it's funny because maybe a year or two ago, the Whiteside-Gobert comparison didn't seem as tilted as heavily in Gobert's favor. I think the case has been pretty established now that Gobert is a much more efficient, effective, and just better overall player than Whiteside is.
You mentioned Donovan Mitchell possibly being the star there. It's hard to give a rookie that sort of, but he is. I mean, he is a star. I mean, just as far as
in the star in the making,
But,
I mean, 100%. He's still struggling though, right? I mean, he's having the occasional big game punctuated by off shooting nights like
yesterday. I thought he had a good game overall yesterday. He stepped in for Ricky Rubio, who was hurt, and so he had a bunch of assists. I mean, he finished the first half with like seven assists, I think. Yeah. And he was overall a positive in the plus minus. Played some good defense, but just you're right, didn't score a bunch. But the Jazz still shot like 50% from the field despite Donovan Mitchell not having a great shooting night. But you're right, like Gobert, the Jazz are kind of like the Heat in that they've got a lot of depth. They can kind of mix and match their starting five to be pretty versatile. And they've got a traditional rim protector like Rudy Gobert, but the difference between Gobert and Whiteside is that Gobert is just way better than Whiteside. Gobert is a legitimate top 15 player probably in the NBA. Like, he is that impactful. That the Jazz season, a lot of people look to Donovan Mitchell, and rightfully so, but their season really turned around when they got Gobert back from injury, right? And he's arguably the most impactful defender in the league right now. So that's just not like, the Heat have Whiteside, but like Gobert is just better Whiteside, like way better Whiteside. I feel like the Jazz are like, from a personnel standpoint, are just better versions of what the Heat have. You look at a guy like Joe Ingles, who is almost just like better James Johnson, right? Where he's just moving around the court, setting screens like crazy. He can run the pick and roll a little bit. He plays point forward for them quite a bit. He is the number one 3-point shooter in the NBA this season. And so, you know, they've got a guy like Donovan Mitchell, who we talked about what Josh Richardson could provide if he was an isolation scorer, a go-to option at the end of a shot clock just to sort of bail the offense out. The Heat don't have that with Dragic or Tyler Johnson or anybody like that in the backcourt. Donovan Mitchell is that. Ricky Rubio is a terrific on-ball defender for a point guard. He's up there with guys like Marcus Smart, Chris Paul, and Kyle Lowry as far as that goes. And the Heat don't have that. That's kind of what stands out to me. I think that the Jazz have they are a tough matchup for that Rockets squad. That series right now is tied at 1-1, and I wouldn't be surprised. Like, I still think the Rockets end up winning. They've got so much firepower on that roster, and I think they're just overall a better team. They're not going to shoot that lousily from the field again, I don't think, in this series. But it's going to be really – that's sort of if you're the Heat if you're not going to break down this roster completely, I think you look at a team like the Jazz as what the next step might look like, you know?
To Miami's credit, they've played Houston well in the past, so it might be a good matchup for a team that's not, you know, traditionally filled with a star on their roster. But at the same time, I think, you know, just the overall personnel, like you said, a much better version of what Miami has on their team.
Let's look at that Boston series. Boston's taking the first game of the series against the Sixers. Is anything standing out to you why? I mean, it looks like the Celtics are a legitimately more competitive team against the Sixers and the Heat were in that first round. And you look at Boston similarly to how you compare the Heat with the Jazz, starless, they're dealing with a lot of injuries. Is there something, why is it that Boston is having more success? Why is it that they're more competitive against the Sixers than the Heat were?
You know, I feel like this is going to be a recurring theme, but guess what? Their center has been pretty good. Al Horford has made a huge difference, at least in game one, but he's made a huge difference for the Celtics throughout the playoffs. I mean, again, a guy that doesn't move the needle as a typical star. He's not somebody that you kind of consider as being one of the top centers in the league, but he's very efficient and effective in what he does. He spreads the floor. He can put the ball down. He creates offense for others. And guess what? He sets pretty good screens, too. So I think that's been a huge difference between what Boston shows against Philadelphia and what Miami did against Philly.
And the other thing, and I keep going back to this as well, they've got guys who can just score when they need to. Terry Rozier, Terry Three Sticks, I mean, he's a legitimate point guard. I mean, he offers something like – Goran Dragic is a better point guard than Rozier, like, right now, but that might not last that much longer. And Rozier does offer something that Dragic doesn't, in that he just gets to the rim. And Dragic doesn't necessarily do that. Dragic is your more traditional point guard. He sets guys up, and I do think that he's better for that. Rozier is just not a facilitator. He's kind of just a one-dimensional player in that respect, but he's going to add that to his game, presumably, eventually. And then they've got guys like Jason Tatum, who can just shoot over guys, who is right now an advanced isolation scorer for a rookie. They just got guys that can just do stuff when it comes down to it, and Miami lost those games against Philadelphia because, again, the same reason that they lost games during the regular season. 4 or 5 minute stretches where they just couldn't score the ball. They just couldn't put it in the basket. And Boston, yeah, they deal with that. They do deal with that, but that's more when those guys are on the bench, right? Like, it's not just an inability. It's not like Stevens is looking for answers. He almost understands, like, all right, here's our 3 or 4 minute stretch. Tatum is on the bench, when Rozier is on the bench, but I'm gonna get him back in there, and we're gonna get right out of it, and we're gonna just get back into this game. And in the playoffs, when guys play more minutes, you know, the Celtics haven't had those stretches as much in the postseason as they did in the regular season. So I just think Boston, at the end of the day, they have those things that you need in the playoffs, and Miami just doesn't have that right now. Let's look at that game two in Cleveland. That game is the first game tonight. Cleveland stole that game in Indiana. Are you a believer?
That's debatable. You could say that Toronto lost that game.
Or Toronto, not Indiana. Nope, that's true too. So Cleveland stole the game either because Toronto wasn't paying attention to the crown jewels or the Cavaliers are super sneaky. Whatever one we want to say. But are you now believing in Cleveland? Like, they've won their last two playoff games.
that's a good streak there to have. But at the same time, I still think that Toronto is capable of eking out this. I mean, they can still win this series, I think. It's tough. I you know, it's kind of funny. You're listening to this crowd, and Toronto has this huge lead midway through the, what was it, the third quarter? Yeah. Maybe. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, the Cavs just start chipping away at it, and you start to hear groans coming from the crowd. Then all of a sudden, the players hang their head a little bit more. Passes that were fluid in the first half just get, you know, intercepted more easily. All of a sudden, they can't take or make shots in the final moments of the game. It's just, didn't they miss like their last 11 shot attempts in regular time and before overtime? I mean, they just, they think they kind of choked. And yeah. I feel like, as much as I'm loath to kind of buy into these narratives, I really do believe that sometimes they feel like they're cursed and just can't seem to find a way to get past LeBron.
I 100% believe in that. Like, how could this not be in your head? Especially after game one. I mean, blowing that game, that could have lost them the series, because they might. I mean, that's what I'm most interested to watch for in this game too tonight. Is how does Toronto respond? Are they going to be in their heads? Are they going to be kind of just like tight and at the start of the game, or are they going to come out with a passion and a fire and just play like they have played all? I said that at the start of the series. I think I said this on Locked On NBA. If the Raptors just come out and play the way they did in the regular season, they should win this. They should just win this series, and it really,
yeah,
and quite easily they should win this series, because they are the better team. I don't even think it's a question. But do they get in their own heads, and does LeBron James do what LeBron James does? And in game one, he did. So, you know, it's going to be really interesting. This is not necessarily a chess match. It's just sort of like, this is a mind game right now, and mostly on Toronto's part. I kind of like what Cleveland has done, playing LeBron James at point guard, surrounding him with shooters, putting Tristan Thompson back on the floor for extended minutes. I think that they're getting their best guys out there, with the exception of Jeff Green. They still go to that weird, like, Jeff Green, Larry Nance, Kevin Love lineup, which I still don't understand. It's like a net rating of, like, minus 26 or something. But
did Nance play game one?
They were not memorable. But I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what happens in game two. But that's all we have for today. We'll be back tomorrow. You can send mailbag questions and ask about advertising by sending an email to lockedonheat@gmail.com. Help share the show by telling your friends and retweeting our links. Music is courtesy of Mojave Wild. We'll catch you next time. Thanks for joining me, Eggs.
You got it, W-dubs.
W-dubs.